Blog Talk Radio.
I think that
Why do you support that, Lila?
Because I think that the people who are already here, who came here as children, whom some came here as infants, they know no other country. They should have legalized citizenship and then tighten up the borders and all that. But you can't send all those people back.
They
want to
send all their parents back. No,
you can't.
They are sending them back.
You can't send all those people back. It's ridiculous.
No.
I think it's just such a waste of time and money. They're part of the workforce. Let them stay. And let's get on with it. Let's move on. They're already here.
Okay.
That's the way I feel about it.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, have them pay taxes and get driver's licenses and do all that sort of stuff.
Lila is a liberal, and we love her for being such. And I am a liberal, but I believe I am more of a, I don't know what I am anymore. But divine rhetoric, God in the inaugural address. President Obama mentioned him five times in Monday's inaugural address, God that is. In modern times, religion has become so intertwined in our political rhetoric that the failure of any president to invoke God in a speech as important as the inaugural could hardly escape notice. Thanks to his graphic in the Wall Street Journal, we notice the president who did nearly all and the few who didn't, Teddy Roosevelt, Rutherford B. Hayes. But the inaugural references to a supreme being have evolved over time, says Ann Duncan, an assistant professor of religion in Goucher College in Boston.
Goucher College.
For example, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, all influenced by the deism that influenced most of the American Revolutionary thinkers, never once mentioned God in their inaugurals. For them, God was a distant, rather distant, but still very provincial and powerful and powerful force, Duncan says. Not the kind of personal God that an evangelical Christian today might talk about. Instead, Washington referred to the almighty being. Adam invoked his providence, and Jefferson spoke of that being in the, whose hands we are.
Martin J. Medhurst, a professor of rhetoric and communication at Baylor, a private Baptist university in Waco, Texas, says formulations such as the Almighty and Divine Providence were part of common language adopted by the revolutionary generation in part to avoid the kind of divisiveness that more specific formulations might engender. In fact, the word God doesn't even show up in an inaugural speech until 1821, when James Monroe vowed during his second inaugural to carry out his presidential duties with a firm reliance on the protection of Almighty God. As an aside, Chester A. Arthur added the phrase, "So help me God," to the presidential oath in 1881 when he was sworn in after the assassination of James Garfield. Every president since has added it too. What changed? Two things. Duncan and Medhurst agree. The dying out of the revolutionary generation that was so reluctant to invoke a personal God, and a Protestant revival that was gathering steam just as Monroe became president. Monroe was apparently as astute a politician as any, and his God reference nearly coincided with the Second Great Awakening, an explosion of Baptist and Methodist congregations in the U.S., that was partly a reaction to the distant deism of the founding fathers. Even so, from the 1820s until the 1850s, as the country moved unstoppably towards civil war, presidents reverted back to the safer territory of Almighty Being and Divine Providence. In his first inaugural, Abraham Lincoln referred to the Almighty Rulers of Nations, but by the time of his second in 1865 at the end of the Civil War, a speech famously inscribed as his memorial in Washington, D.C., Lincoln talked of God. Both sides in the Civil War had been using God as justification for what they were doing, Duncan says. With his side victorious, Lincoln certainly had the opportunity to say, "See, God is on our side." But instead, he chased both sides for speaking on behalf of God. Lincoln's words, "Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us judge not, that we not be judged. From Lincoln's time forward, most presidents have invoked God in their inaugural speeches. Theodore Roosevelt was a notable exception. Duncan called Roosevelt an interesting blip in the trajectory of our American civil religion. He had a real hesitancy to insert that language and really tried to restrain himself from doing that. That's been unique, she says. Roosevelt eschewed any interpenetration of church and state, says Bayless Medhurst. For him, I'm pretty sure it would have been an intentional move not to have any particular religious language in that speech. Since World War I, every incoming president has made the God reference.
If you look at the world wars, both of them, how religious language was used, it's pretty incredible how effective both Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt used religious imagery to swing public opinion from an otherwise deeply entrenched reluctance to enter into war into an almost crusade mentality among many people, Duncan says. Both of Obama's inaugural speeches mentioned God the same number of times, 5, more than either of his predecessors, George W. Bush, 2 inaugural speeches, 3 times each. Ronald Reagan, the second inaugural, holds the record with 8 references, while Richard Nixon mentioned God 6 times in his first inaugural in 1969.
Do you think the more times you mention God, the evil, more evil you are?
Probably so. No.
You're trying to cover up all the evil doing you're trying to do?
Yeah.
And all the things you really don't believe
yeah.
in? You just wonder sometimes if people insert poor God as an excuse for their poor choices and their bad doings.
This is interesting. The GOP, Obama's very ideological speech not wearing well.
Well, I'm sure they say that.
Yeah.
Do they have
Ryan here.
Oh, I can't stand that man.
Well, no, most people can't, but,
I wonder that if somebody like that gets elected.
He may wind up being your next Republican presidential nominee in 2016. President Obama's inauguration, Capitol Hill on Tuesday, who ran for vice president on a losing Republican ticket last year, said Obama's inaugural address showed a proud and confident liberal progressive. If President Obama's second inaugural address did anything for conservatives, it was to reaffirm their suspicions of the president as an unreconstructed liberal with whom they won't find much, if any, common ground during his just stated second term. A day after the president's speech, that view appeared to be heartening. Representative Ryan of Wisconsin, 2012 Republican vice presidential nominee, who at least now is considered a strong contender for 2016 GOP nomination, very likely spoke for many conservatives Tuesday. The Laura Ingraham Show radio interview, Ryan said he wasn't surprised that the president's speech didn't seem to have an attempt to reach out to political adversaries. That's what speechwriters or historians usually note, that inaugurals are meant to be that. Campaign's over.
Bring everybody together.
And try to unify. And that's not the speech we got. To be candid, I wasn't really surprised by the speech. The president is proud and confident liberal progressive. He invoked the Constitution and Declaration at times, which is something everybody likes to hear, especially conservatives. But he invoked them sort of as a means to legitimize the agenda he was going forward, which is very partisan, very ideological, for sure. It does surprise me. It does surprise me that he...
That he did that
because he basically saying, I am a liberal and I'm going to govern as a liberal and I won, and so there.
I didn't get that impression at all.
Yeah, you got to remember it's Ryan talking. Ryan's a dickhead.
Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, accused Obama of badly misstating the Republican position on entitlement beneficiaries, saying the GOP policymakers don't label those who received earned entitlements like Social Security and Medicare as takers. Oh, yeah, yes, they do.
They sneer when
they say the word entitlement.
Earned entitlements.
That's right.
Sure, you put that in.
Mm-hmm. Instead, Ryan said conservatives are talking about beneficiaries who receive entitlements like Medicaid, the joint federal-state program that pays for health care for the poor, which they didn't pay for through payroll taxes. What are they supposed to do, go on the street? The guest host filling in for Egram didn't ask Ryan how he would label the middle-income elderly who got their long-term nursing home stays paid for by Medicaid. And having a night to sleep on the president's speech, Senate Republicans alleged on Tuesday that Obama, freed from having to run for re-election, finally revealed to the world how much of a liberal throwback he actually is. You want to hear that?
Sure.
Taking his second term, here's a little audio.
On the liberal agenda.
Yeah, it's like 44 seconds.
Some are calling the president's address the most liberal he's delivered.
The most liberal speech Barack Obama has ever given.
Much more radical than the speech he gave 4 years ago.
He doesn't have the time for re-election again.
This is clearly a president who is not running for re-election.
Unapologetically liberal.
I think you'll have a lot of them saying that finally the president is laying out his real agenda. And guess what? He's a liberal.
I came out of the closet as a liberal.
This is very liberal.
The progressive liberal agenda is what he's now clearly
saying. Everybody knew the guy was.
What a surprise.
Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, told reporters that after senators of both parties left their weekly lunchtime party meetings, one thing that's pretty clear from the president's speech yesterday, the era of liberalism is back. An unabashedly far left of center inauguration speech certainly brings back memories of the Democratic Party of the ages past. If the president pursues that kind of agenda, obviously, it's not designed to bring us together and certainly not designed to heal with the transcendent issue of our era, which is deficit and debt. Until we fix that problem, we can't fix America, and we cannot leave behind for our kids the kind of America that our parents left behind for us.
At the same gaggle with journalist Senator John Thune of South Dakota suggested that the president gave evidence of his liberal bent by what he left out of his speech. Well, we were reminded yesterday that this is a liberal president with a liberal agenda. Which is why the words spending and debt probably weren't included in that speech. We happen to believe that the biggest threat to America's future is runaway government spending, except when it's runaway and spent on things they want. And debt that we're piling on the backs of future generations of Americans. They don't believe that at all. They're the ones that cause
the debt.
As long as it goes to the very rich and to the stupid programs that they want to support and to bombs and invasions, they have no problem with it. Meanwhile, Crossroads GPS, the nonprofit linked to Karl Rove's American Crossroads Political Action Committee, was back in campaign mode Tuesday with a new video that sought to dam up Obama by using the words of journalists and pundits who describe Obama's speech as embracing a liberal agenda. If the media is calling Obama's policies liberal, what can we expect in the next 4 years is how the video ends. That's what we just played. The conservative reading of Obama's speech, such as that by Nicholas Eberstadt, said in an interview Tuesday, we are not in the if you have a better idea, let me hear it portion of the show anymore. It's also strikingly different from the previous Democratic president, from President Clinton, who talked about mend it, don't end it, said Eberstadt, who wrote a blog post taking issue with the president. What's missing here is any notion that there's anything to be mended. No problem. Well, what do they expect how they treated him for 4 years? You know, they wouldn't.
Said right off the bat that they were going to destroy him.
Yeah.
They said that, and Mitch McConnell said that.
Yeah, we're going to destroy you. We're the party of no. We're not going to compromise.
The president's argument is that we have finished discussing the welfare state, which I said in an interview Tuesday. We are not in the if you have a better idea, let me hear it portion of the show.
I just read that. The reaction, I read that. I read all that. The reaction a day after the speech tracked pretty much with instant GOP reaction immediately following the speech. Roll call reported Monday. Senator Rob Portman, Republican, Ohio, gushed about the civility of the ceremonial lunch Monday, but indicated that his party's disappointment with the president's inaugural speech could boil over the next time he pays a call to the Capitol.
Parts of it sounded more like a Capitol speech.
Campaign speech.
And part of it was soaring rhetoric, which was positive. I thought about getting together, Portman told Roll Call. He noted he is absolutely looking to the States of the Union on February 12th, 3 weeks from Tuesday, to hear more details. So I just thought that was interesting to know.
It sounds to me like they expected Obama to kiss their ass.
Yeah.
And I think he's had it with that. He tried every which way to compromise with them.
And he almost lost his election because he compromised. And, he wasn't strong enough.
He tried every way to deal with them, and they were the party of no. They refused to make any kind of compromises. So what do they expect?
Here's something else that's interesting. Don't expect the states to cooperate.
Green, black.
Blue states and red states are moving further apart. That's one of the clear lessons from the annual State of the States report, which the Pew Center on the States is rolling out in the string of assessments this week. States are now governed pretty much by one party or the other. Nearly as often as not, one party holds not just power, but supermajority status in legislatures. How you doing, Connecticut?
Yeah.
That means states will be moving in entirely different directions on issues such as abortion, same-sex marriage, drug policy, and health care, according to the report. There have already been clear contrasts this year in the approaches taken by blue states such as New York and red states like Tennessee when it comes to guns. Last week, Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, Democrat, proposed a $2 billion tax increase, the first income tax hike in the Commonwealth in 20 years. By contrast, Republicans Bobby Jindal of Louisiana and Dave Hennemann of Nebraska both hope to abolish the income tax in their states. Republicans may not hold the reins in Washington, but they hold the bulk of power in states. The GOP holds 30 of the 50 state governorships, and as Pew notes, last November, elections ratified most of the gains Republicans made in legislatures due to the historic sweep 2 years earlier. I didn't know the majority of the governments or states were GOP. Now Republicans control both the legislature and the governorships in 7 of the nation's 10 largest states: Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Georgia, Michigan, and North Carolina. All told, half the nation's population, 166 million people, live in the 25 states under total GOP dominance, compared with 93 million people in 13 Democrat-dominated states, according to Josh Goodman, a small writer, a staff writer with Pew. Right?
Democrats did register some gains last November, Goodman points out. The fact that the two parties between them enjoy near total control of the majority of states, so means both can experiment with bold ideas, whether it's abolishing the income tax or legalizing marijuana. Pew suggests that the state budget situation, which has been miserable for the past several years, remains fragile. But states now do have a bit more money to play with, according to the National Association of State Budget Officers. Total revenues are expected to surpass pre-recession levels this year for the first time. State spending overall is expected to go up 2.2% this year, the association says. That's modest by historic standards. Some states, including Washington and Kansas, are still facing big budget shortfalls. And states in general are nervous about the continuing budget uncertainty out of the nation's capital. Automatic spending cuts, currently set to kick in March 1st, would have a big impact on the state's bottom lines, as would potential changes in federal tax policy. Many state tax codes are linked to federal ones. All this uncertainty really puts a crimp on the potential for companies individuals and states to embark on serious planning for the future. Sujit Kanajaratne, a senior fiscal analyst at the Council of State Governments, told Stateline, "We're lurching from one crisis to another and not having any set plan." As Pew notes, states can be expected to have a sometimes combative relationship with Washington over the next couple of years. Some still are sorting out whether they'll participate in expanding Medicaid and creating health insurance exchanges, as called for under the 2010 Affordable Care Act. Many Republican governors, although not all, have been skeptical. Texas Republican Greg Abbott was among a group of attorney generals who sued to block the federal health law, and he also has taken legal action against a host of other federal laws. "I got to the office, I sue the federal government, and then I go home," Abbott said in a speech last year, according to the New York Times. Isn't the Texas governor just a ceremonial job?
Yeah.
He doesn't even run the state. He just cuts ribbons and smiles at store openings.
Yeah, but he's still...
He's the attorney general.
Whatever that dickhead is. What's his name?
I can't think of him.
Oh, jeez. He's forgotten already. What's his name? For the governor of Texas.
I can't think of his name.
Oh, my God. I can't believe we've forgotten him already.
I know. I can't think of his name.
What the hell is it?
But it's just a ceremonial position.
But he was such a blowhard during the whole year, and I forgot his name. It's amazing how fast.
Yeah, he was running, right?
Yeah, he was the president.
And we used to laugh every time he came
on. He was an idiot.
Yeah.
He was a complete idiot.
All he does is smile and kiss babies.
I forgot his name.
I could see his fat face. He had kind of a chubby face.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did. He had like a round face and dark hair. And
round face?
Yeah. Wasn't a bad looking man. He had dark hair. I can't think of his name.
Come on, Lila.
Sorry, you don't know it, so don't stop badgering me.
You and I are terrible. We forget people's names. We're name forgetters.
Well, we thought he was kind of an idiot, so we moved on.
We knew he wasn't going to do anything.
So in that file, in the head?
What the hell was his name?
No room.
What the hell was his name? Come on. Governor of Texas. That's insane. We're not infallible, I guess. Lila, we're not infallible. My God.
Let's look at the legislative voting records. I think that'd be kind of interesting. Let's just see what they say on that. Go right down there and see if there's anything. Oh, you have to go in.
No, we don't want to do that.
No.
Lots of trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to... House postpones debt limit deadline to May 18th.
Yeah.
I think that's hysterical. They're just pushing it off.
Now, isn't it that they're not going to get paid unless they...
Unless they do this, they're not going to get paid, so they're going to have to do it. Can't have Congress not get paid. Let's see. Okay. The House of Representatives, led by Speaker John Boehner and his Republican allies, voted to put off the debt ceiling fight until May 18th. This is good news, no doubt about it, and it shows the power of working people when they make their voices heard. But don't think for a second that Republicans have given up trying to tank the economy to get their way, or trying to cut Social Security, Medicare benefits. Are trying to cut taxes for Wall Street and rich people, because they haven't and they won't. This fight is still on.
Think of the debt ceiling as the first skirmish in the larger struggle to stand up for working families and honor the results of the past election. There are two more budget battles on the horizon. One is about canceling across-the-board budget cuts scheduled for March. The other is the threat by Republicans in Congress to shut down the government on March 27th. and there may be a third budget battle over raising the debt ceiling again in May. Since Republicans have not given up holding the economy hostage to get their way, and have not even changed the ransom demands, working people will keep telling our elected representatives the same thing we've been telling them for months. No benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Cancel the across-the-board budget cuts scheduled for March, and close loopholes for Wall Street and the richest 2% of Americans instead. Some of our friends on Capitol Hill seem to be getting the message. Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, recently called on Republicans to stop already with the manufactured budget crisis and the hostage taking. For years, congressional Republicans have used every crisis they could manufacture to litigate the federal budget outside the regular budget process without any regard for the impact of their actions on workers and the economy. From threats of government shutdown each time an appropriation bill was about to lapse, to the artificial debt ceiling crisis of 2011 that required the Budget Control Act, to the year-end physical cliff brinkmanship, Republicans have time and again pulled the budget negotiations out of the budget committees in a way that rattled the markets, hurt the economy, and increased uncertainty. In fact, on the very same day that Republicans came out with their latest effort to hold the debt limit hostage in an acclaimed attempt to move the budget process toward regular order, they doubled down on their plan to use the up-and-coming negotiations on sequestration and a potential government shutdown to extract more cuts to programs seniors and middle-class families depend on. Republicans can either say they want to have a budget debate in the budget committees, or they can say they would prefer to negotiate the issue, lurching from crisis to crisis, but they can't say both. It simply doesn't make sense. So if Republicans are truly interested in moving this debate back into the budget committees and back to regular order, they ought to actually deliver on the rhetoric. This means putting a stop to the debt limit hostage-taking, ending the constant brinkmanship, and truly engaging in an honest effort to work with us toward the balanced and bipartisan budget deal the American people expect and deserve. After passage in the House, the legislation to temporarily suspend the debt ceiling now moves on to the Senate, where Majority Leader Harry Reid said he will bring the bill up for a vote without any changes. President Obama also said he will not oppose this delay.
So, you know, it's same old.
Yeah, they don't want to work in the committees because they don't really want to fix it.
That's right. So
it's just a bunch of rhetoric on their part. That's all it is.
Yeah. Market discipline for the Boeing 787. It's such a waste as far as I was going to, you know, to see that kind of problem. And Boeing is saying that the biggest problem with that is outsourcing.
Yeah. Really?
Yep. It says, my career invested in the aerospace industry, so it's very sobering to me when the Federal Aviation Administration ordered that 787 airplanes be grounded.
787.
No, the 787.
No.
That 787 airplanes be grounded.
That 787 airplanes.
Lila, it's the 787.
No, that isn't what that says.
Discipline for the Boeing 787.
That isn't what that
they
says.
They didn't ground 787 airplanes. They ordered that the 787 airplanes be grounded.
They didn't write that properly.
Right, but it's a 787. Friends asked me to explain the situation. What lessons can we draw from the 787? Invariably, we start with outsourcing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you know it, huh?
Yeah, they outsourced the damn thing.
To China? And they wonder why.
Probably more than one country.
A lot of different places, probably.
Yeah.
And I wonder where they got assembled.
It's curious.
We can find out.
Up here eventually. I don't know why it's slow coming.
Well, I thought the problem was the lithium battery.
Oh, that's just one problem.
There's a whole bunch of problems.
Okay. Hang on, folks. It's coming.
Where is it?
Wonk blog.
The Washington Post. It's been a miserable week for Boeing. Federal investigators have grounded all of the U.S. company's new and much-hyped 787 Dreamliner jets after reports that the aircraft's lithium-ion batteries were overheating and catching on fire.
Already a favorite culprit has emerged: outsourcing. Critics have long charged that Boeing was far too reliant on offshore suppliers for the 787's production. More than 30% of the jetliner's components came from overseas, including the Japanese-made lithium iron battery, which is now garnering all the headlines. By contrast, just 5% of the parts of its predecessors, the 747, were foreign-made. But why should outsourcing matter here? After all, it's not as if Japan is incapable of making decent lithium iron batteries. And this is where the argument gets a bit fuzzier. One possibility is that Boeing's far-flung network of suppliers made it that much trickier for the U.S.-based manufacturer to spot and evaluate systematic problems. Here's the Globe and Mail's Guy Dixon making that case.
But the vast collection of components by hundreds of suppliers that go into a 787 makes troubleshooting potentially more difficult. Although outsourcing has always been a part of commercial aviation, the difference now is the complexity and codependence of the electronics operating the aircraft. Aerospace consultant Scott Hamilton quotes an engineer who raises similar worries. There aren't that many qualified outside experts except at Airbus. Where are they going to get them from, he says. This is where the extreme outsourcing really causes problems. How are they going to get their suppliers to be truthful? That has always been a problem in the aeronautics. The 787 organization makes it much, much worse.
These concerns are hardly novel. Back in 2011, Michael Hilzik published a long piece for the Los Angeles Times questioning Boeing's over-reliance on foreign suppliers for the Dreamliner. That piece, however, was largely focused on delays and cost overruns. The drawback of this approach emerged early, Hilzik wrote. Some of the pieces manufactured by far-flung suppliers didn't fit together. Some subcontractors couldn't meet their output quotas and creating high production log jams when critical parts were available in the necessary sequence. Mm-hmm. And the criticisms go back even further than that, over at Quartz. Tim Furz dredges up a memo from an aerospace engineer who warned Boeing way back in 2001 that outsourcing wasn't always a savvy business decision. A strong case will not always be possible to make more and more profit out of less and less product, and that's worse. There is a strong risk of going out of business directly as a result of this policy.
That said, it's worth adding a note of caution here. It's not yet clear what exactly is wrong with the 787. James Fallow suggests that if it's merely a battery issue, that may be specific and correctable rather than some mysterious, unbounded threat that could undo the 787 project as a whole. Nor is it even certain that outsourcing was to blame for this particular battery failure. On that, we're still waiting for the details. But there's a side story here that's also worth knowing. Putting the 787 specific battery issues aside, in recent years, a number of companies seems to be rethinking the sort of offshoring practices that Boeing, among others, has pursued so heavily. An Economist piece this week outlined the trend. Most firms do not give enough thought to choosing where to produce. To an alarming degree, says McKinsey, companies continue to indulge in herd behavior when deciding where to base their operations and how to arrange their supply chains. Many of them, says the consulting firm, simply follow each other around to low-cost countries or allow themselves to be drawn in by governments waving a wand of cash and other incentives. Two sets of strategic problems can arise from offshore production to another part of the world, especially if it is poorly thought out. The first of these concerns, the logistics of supply. The more the firm spreads their operations around the globe, the more vulnerable they become to disruption from unexpected events such as natural disasters or political unrest. The second strikes at the heart of what companies try to do, sell more or better widgets to customers than their rival down the road. Often the more a firm offshores and outsources, the worse it will be at responding to customers quickly. This piece takes pains to stress that offshoring isn't always a disaster. Sometimes it really does help companies become more profitable, though it's not necessarily good for domestic workers. Yet many firms now seem to be realizing that practice doesn't make sense in all situations. This will be something to watch for in years ahead, long after Boeing manages to get the 787 up and flying again. Well, maybe.
But, you know, it's a poor management decision.
Well, they're saying it wasn't well thought out. That could kill that company.
Yeah. Oh, great. More CEOs telling us we need to cut.
We read that last time. Yeah.
We did?
Uh-huh.
We did.
Uh-huh. We read that.
Yeah,
a lot of these.
Okay. Yeah, it goes back
a little bit. Yeah, those all go back to kind of old.
Okay. Well, why don't we change course and go over to another blog that we like a lot.
I like this AFL-CIO Now blog. They bring a lot of really current good stuff.
Yeah, they do.
And they also, you know, have good researchers. Whoever writes for this, they do their research.
Yeah.
And they come up with very good positions, I think, and good justifications for what they believe, which is always, you know, delightful. And it's a treat to read a lot of the stuff, I think.
Well, I'm going to go to a quick music break, and then
okay.
We'll be back in a few minutes.
All right. Let's play a little bit of that.
Okay.
I think that might be interesting.
Yeah. Hunger-in-chief, 20,000 airstrikes in the president's first term caused death and destruction from Iraq to Somalia. I think that's interesting. 20,000, I didn't know that, did you?
Well, I knew that he had had a lot of...
20,000 airstrikes?
I knew there were a lot of airstrikes. I can't imagine how much that cost. What a waste of money. You could have bought those countries. What would it cost? Just go in and purchase them. Give the people food and they become Americans.
It says shock claim. Obama only wants military leaders who will fire on U.S. citizens.
Maybe we should read that.
Yeah. On Monday, renowned author and humanitarian Dr. Jim Garrow made a shocking claim about what he can expect to see in Obama's second term. Garrow made the following Facebook post. I have just been informed by a former senior military leader that Obama is using a new litmus test in determining who will stay and who must go in his military leaders. Get ready to explode, folks. The new litmus test of leadership in the military is that they will fire on U.S. citizens or not. Those who will not are being removed. That is sick. That is sick. So now we can understand the need for our own assault rifles. Oops. Buy your assault rifle today.
This is from the trenches.
So who is the source? Garrow replied, the man who told me this is one of America's foremost military heroes. Understand this is not coming from Alex Jones or Jesse Ventura or from anyone else that left off and dismisses with great ease. Garrow is a well-respected activist and has spent much of his life rescuing infant girls from China, babies who would be killed under the country's one-child policy. He was also nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work.
So was Obama.
The bio on Amazon.com reads, Dr. James Garrow is the author of Pink Pagoda, One Man's Quest to End Gendercide in China. He has spent over $25 million over the past 16 years rescuing an estimated 40,000 baby Chinese girls from near certain death under China's one-child per couple policy by facilitating international adoptions. He is the founder and executive director of the Bethune Institute, Big Pagoda Schools, private English immersion schools for Chinese children. Today he runs 168 schools with nearly 6,300 employees. Wow. This comes on the heels of Sunday's report, Washington Free Beacon, that the head of Central Command, Marine Corps General James Mattis, is being dismissed by Obama and will leave his post on March. The WFP article states, word on the national security street is that General James Mattis is being given the bum's rush out of his job as commander of Central Command and is being told to vacate his office several months earlier than planned. Did General Mattis refuse to fire on U.S. citizens?
Yeah.
Probably true.
Go back.
Where is it?
No, just go back.
I can't go back. There it is.
Oh, there it is.
second, folks. He has to keep going. This is kind of interesting. I read this earlier. Let's read this one. We get about 10 minutes. Goldman Sachs food speculation turns global hunger into Wall Street profit. Giant makes $400 million as high-risk commodity trading pushes already fragile food system to breaking point. As the world's most vulnerable populations succumb to surging global food prices, driven in part by drought, climate change, and global food system increasingly vulnerable to the whims of commodity speculation, Goldman Sachs has managed to turn the property and suffering of others into profits for itself. I remember reading something about this a while back that they were pushing us, but this is quite interesting. This is from Common Dreams. Pulling in more than $400 million in profits last year, thoroughly risking and damaging food speculation prices, the Wall Street financial titan has once again profited from others' misfortune, Independent reports Tuesday. According to an analysis conducted for the Independent by the World Development Movement, 2012 investment practices in the soft commodities trade, wheat and maize, by financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs drove prices to unprecedented levels, while bank profits increased and bankers' bonuses were handed out readily. Goldman's food speculation contributed to a roughly 68% jump in profits for 2012, Independent reports, while it's increased the average pay and bonus packages of its bankers to nearly $396,500. Christine Haig of the WDM stated, while nearly a billion people go hungry, Goldman Sachs bankers are feeding their own bonuses by betting on the food prices, price of food. Financial speculation is fueling food price spikes, and Goldman Sachs is the number one culprit.
What a surprise, huh?
Independent exclaims, Goldman makes its food speculation revenues by setting up and managing commodity funds that invest money from pension funds, insurance companies, and wealthy individuals in return for fees and commissions. The firm invented these kinds of funds and continues to dominate the market, together with Barclays and Morgan Stanley. Swiss trading giant Glencore hit the headlines in August when its head of agriculture proclaimed that the U.S. drought would be good for Glencore. The extent of Goldman's food speculation can be revealed after the U.N. warned that the world could face a major hunger crisis in 2013 after failed harvests in the U.S. and Ukraine. Both food prices surged last summer, with cereal prices hitting a record high in September. As the global food crisis has worsened due to extreme weather droughts on all global climate change, Rob Nash, Oxfam's private sector advisor, says the group is increasingly alarmed by the financial food speculation, especially in the light of increasingly extreme weather conditions, which can reduce supply suddenly and severely deplete stocks, he says. And the last thing the world's poor needs is for that volatility to be exacerbated by speculation exploited for short-term profit. So, hell to that goddamn company, Goldman Sachs.
It's a nightmare company. Destruction
that's
done. Yeah. Ruined so many lives.
I'm going to read this because this is I've been doing a lot of research in this area for quite some time. And I think it might be worth ending the show with. What is the pineal gland?
Ooh, okay.
The pineal gland is regarded as one of the most important parts of your nervous system. It is shrouded in mystery, but as more and more people investigate it, they are realizing it is essential, a spiritual antenna. The mystical third eye that ancient traditions have been talking about. For eons, the third eye has been seen as a way to reach higher levels of consciousness while still being present in the physical body. This concept of the pineal gland being the seat of the soul or the spiritual gateway of all realms and all dimensions is important to realizing its full function. Before you can reach the spiritual gateway, you must start the practice of both detoxifying your pineal gland and activating your pineal gland through methods such as changes in diet, how to decalcify your pineal gland, and spiritual practices such as meditation and visualization. And I wanted to mention this because fluoridation is one of the major causes for calcification of the pineal gland. And that's why so many people, myself included and Lila, want to force the ending of stop fluoridation. Do you want to read some of this?
Sure. If you could just point to me where we are, I guess.
Right here.
The concept of the pineal gland being the seat of the soul or the spiritual gateway to all realms and all dimensions is important to realizing its full function. Before you can reach this spiritual gateway, you must start the practice of both detoxifying your pineal gland and activating your pineal gland through methods such as changes in diet and spiritual practices such as meditation and visualization. The medical profession describes the pineal gland as being a small endocrine gland in the vertebrate brain that produces the serotonin derivative melatonin, a hormone that affects the modulation of wake-sleeping patterns and seasonal functions. Its shape resembles a tiny pine cone, hence its name, and is located near the center of the brain between the two hemispheres, tucked in a groove where the 200 rounded where the two rounded thalamic bodies join. Not 200. Two rounded thalamic
bodies. Pineal gland location.
Let's turn that on.
Yeah. It's an hour and 3 minutes. But the pineal gland is a midline structure shaped like a pine cone and is often seen in plain skull x-rays as it is often calcified. Calcification has been shown in one small study to correlate with the accumulation of fluoride. Mm-hmm. The pine cone shape of the pineal gland is a very interesting topic. Symbolically, many organizations, both religious and spiritual, have used the pine cone as an icon. Watch David Wilcox's video called Enigma for more information. That's this one here. But pineal gland composition. Pineal gland contains a number of things, including pinocytes, in which non-mammalian vertebrae have a strong resemblance to the photoreceptor cells of the eye. Some evolutionary biologists believe that the vertebrate pineal cells share a common evolutionary ancestor in the retinal cells. In some vertebrates, exposure to light can set off a chain reaction of enzymatic events within the pineal gland that regulate circadian rhythms. Some early vertebrate fossil skulls have pineal opening. This correlates with the physiology of the modern living fossils. It goes on and on. But the key is to remember that you have the pineal gland is the third eye. And oddly enough, cannabis and the pineal gland turns on the third eye. Cannabis as a method of decalcifying the pineal gland. What is calcification? What causes it? Calcification is the buildup of calcium phosphate crystals in various parts of the body. It is a natural process caused primarily by nanobacteria. Nanobacteria are small microorganisms that form calcium phosphate shells around themselves, essentially to protect themselves from your immune system. It is these cells that accumulate in our pineal glands and ultimately calcify it. Furthermore, it is becoming apparent that many researchers are finding that this may be the cause of most diseases, from arthritis to stroke, from cancer to pain to back pain. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most people's pineal glands are heavily calcified. It ends up becoming so calcified that under the scans, it is seen as a lump of calcium, essentially blinding our third eye. That's fluoride does that. And due to the horrific Western diets and food systems, most people are being exposed to far more of these organisms than ever before. And not only that, are being calcified through other means as well, which we covered. How to calcify your pineal gland. Excuse me. I'm going to recommend this article because you could go to it. And there's another thing here. We're already up on time. Okay. But I want to go to Waking Times and check this out. Cannabis and the pineal gland, turn on the third eye. The pineal gland of the seat of the soul, as described by René Descartes, is the focus point of the folk of the spiritual guiding system and makes us go beyond the five senses of the rationality, become multisensory, tuned into the aware of higher dimensions of consciousness within a holographic cosmos. Cannabis or marijuana, among other psychedelics, facilitates the activation of the pineal gland and helps turn on the third eye, or the eye, mind's eye, directing our spiritual evolution to wholeness. Pineal gland, located in the center of the brain, is about a quarter of an inch in size, reddish gray, and weighs about 1/10 of a gram. Like other parts of the brain, which comes in pairs, the pineal gland is singular. Its location in the brain, the center of the brain, and presence in other species indicates that it's an older part of humanity's evolutionary brain system. Pineal gland is present in all lower vertebrae. In other species like birds, reptiles, and frogs, the pineal gland is called the parietal eye, or third eye, as it functions closely resembles that of an actual eye. In these other species, the pineal gland has components of an actual eye with a cornea rod cone. It is considered to be the vestige of a functional sense organ of early primitive vertebrae. And directly affected by this light taken in those eyes, in through the eyes, the pineal regulates sleep, menstrual cycles, mating seasons, hibernation, seasonal flight patterns, and many other instinctual behaviors. That's incredible. I'm going to ask you to go through this because it's a long article with a number of videos and stuff. But you can check into that. It's called Awakening Times.
Hmm.
Right? And I believe .com. But I would definitely check that. And with that, third eye. And I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. And appreciate it. And we hope to have you join us tomorrow night when I go into the fourth dimension. We'll talk to you then. Okay, Lyle?
Yep. And I want to say goodnight to the folks at home. Hope they enjoyed the show.
Yeah.
And I hope people stay warm. It's pretty cold out there. And Leo will come back and talk to you tomorrow, and I'll talk to you next week. Have a good night, folks.
Everybody.
I'm trying to get my music to go down, and I
don't know why. Because you're not pressing. Yeah, it's not working. I don't know why. It's happened like this. It's like my normal song.
Huh.
There we go. All right, good night, everyone.